Part 4. Good Endings. Chapter 18. Leaving SNL. About a year after I met Fritz, I got nominated for an Emmy for Saturday Night Live, a huge deal for me. I remember doing a handstand in my little studio apartment because I was so excited. I shouted, "Yippee!" all by myself. A woman from SNL hadn't been nominated in over 20 years, not since Jane Curtin in 1978. This was before there was a separate variety show category, so I was up against Cher, Billy Crystal, Chris Rock, and Eddie Izzard in the Outstanding Performance in a Variety or Music Program category. I was thrilled. I decided to leave SNL after the 2000-2001 season. I wasn't leaving to do a TV show or a movie. I was just leaving because I wanted to develop a personal life. I had been so work-oriented for so long. Some people leave and they want to just work more, and I was not like that. I wanted to go get coffee with friends and start a family. I wanted to enjoy my life and take a break from work, and I wanted to spend more time with my dad. So I wasn't leaving to go anywhere. I just felt that it was time. I wanted a good ending. I only knew awful, abrupt endings because of my childhood. Because I treasured and loved my time at SNL, I really yearned for a good ending. I was really worried about how Lorne would feel. I was so grateful for the opportunity he had given me and the kindness with which he had treated me throughout my time on the show. I talked with him a lot in the months leading up to my decision. It was very hard to go because it's such a special place. But because I had done it for 6 full seasons, because I loved it so much, I really wanted to leave when I still loved it. And I wanted to leave with dignity and thoughtfulness because I cared so much about Lorne and the show. I didn't want to stay on too long, phoning it in. I wanted to leave in the most respectful, loving way. I also thought, you've got to pass the torch to other young, hungry performers ready for that opportunity. I said all that to Lorne, and he was really understanding about my decision. He didn't want me to leave, but he honored my hopes to take it all slowly and make the most of my last few months on SNL. The perceptive Tina Fey, who just started doing Weekend Update, told me, Lorne's not really accepting the fact that you're leaving. But as Lorne and I kept talking, we came up with a plan. I would leave the show in February and come back for a primetime special that was scheduled for Mother's Day. I said I really want to come back and do it. And Lorne said, of course. All the cast mothers would be performing with their kids, and my mom for the night would be my dad. I would have stayed and finished out the season if there was some reason I couldn't have come back for this special show. That's how important it was for me that my dad got to be on the show. Maya Rudolph, whose mother, the singer Minnie Riperton, had died when Maya was 6, was going to have her dad there too. After we came up with that plan, a going-away announcement came out in the New York Times. My dad said he liked how sad I looked in the photo that went along with the announcement. It shows how much you care, Molly. In February, my dad flew out to see me in my last ever SNL. I'd also invited Fritz and his dad to be there. Before coming downtown to my place, my dad stopped at the Hyatt Regency Bar near Grand Central, where he met a straight, preppy, super nice college boy and brought him back to my place downtown. And so here's this college-age stranger in my apartment with my dad. I had moved to a bigger one-bedroom. It was the first time in a very long time I had seen my dad drunk. He had been sober for years. He started slurring, "Molly, this is David. David is a college student." And I was so mad at him. This was a big week for me. It was Thursday. I was on the way out the door to rehearse for my very last show. But I decided that we should eat something, or he should, to sober up. So we all went out to the Tavern on Jane for burgers. The college kid just sat there while my dad and I had a fight. I was so mad and so mean, and I thought, oh, this poor kid in the middle of all this darkness. To this day, I do not know who this kid was or what my dad had told him. I felt very sorry for him for having to see all that. He was really nice. He was drinking too. Maybe that made it less awkward for him. Anyway, at some point he left. And I ended up telling my dad that he couldn't stay with me, that he had to go stay in a hotel. I wasn't being codependent. I'd never really done anything like that to him before. I remember thinking the whole scene was pathetic and sad. but I was so mad at him for drinking and making it all about him. After I made my dad stay at the hotel, I called Stephen Levy and told him about the whole flare-up. I'm so pissed off at my dad. He showed up drinking. He brought this poor college kid along. But Stephen kept defending him. It was weird. Instead of sympathizing with me, he said, "Molly, you're being too hard on him. You don't understand how much he's given up for you and Mary. He sacrificed so much of himself, so much of his life for both of you." I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Eventually, I cut him off and I said, "What are you talking about? Why are you defending him like that? What are you trying to say?" Then something clicked in my head. Stephen is gay. I paused for a second and I asked, "Are you saying he's gay?" "I don't want to say anything. He wants to tell you, but he's scared. He's going to tell you." "Wow. Oh my God. Oh my God." "We've been talking," Stephen continued, "and he's ready for you to know. He just doesn't know how to tell you." "He's going to tell me?" In that moment, and all at once, I felt my heart grow 1,000 sizes. All the pieces began to fit together. I was so excited and I started making plans for him. He was going to go dancing at gay clubs. He was going to fall in love. My head went wild with visions of his new life as an openly gay man. He was going to be just like Christopher Plummer in Beginners. Suddenly, everything made sense. The craziness, the drinking, the anger. I realized he hadn't gotten to be himself. Deep compassion, love, and understanding just flooded in. I told Fritz, but Fritz was cautious. "I don't know," he said. "He's pretty old." Ugh, I wish I had known this about my dad before, I thought. I could have talked to him. The next morning, I walked over to his hotel and found him on the street outside getting cash at an ATM and shivering so hard. He said, "I'm just going to go home." He said there hadn't been any heat in his room. He was cold all night long, but he started to calm down after a few minutes. We called a truce and went to my favorite little coffee shop, La Bonbonniere, across the street from his hotel, where a very warm and kind waitress named Marina went out of her way to make us both feel better. She knew my dad from all the trips he made to visit me in New York City when I was doing SNL. After we got a table and I said, "Look, this last show is such a big deal for me and I was just so disappointed that you showed up drinking. It makes me feel stressed." He understood and really apologized. So he decided not to leave. And I let him come back up and stay at my apartment. Yay! My dad had opened up to Stephen Levy about a year before. Stephen had called him on the phone after having dinner with us one night and just spoken his mind. "Jim, you're gay." My dad said, "Yes, I probably am." They started exchanging stories and talking through all the challenges they had both faced. Stephen had lost his father as a young boy, so I think he saw the relationship with my dad as a chance to help someone, to be a good surrogate son. And once they got to know each other, he talked on the phone a lot with my dad. It was thanks to my dad's advice that Stephen met his now husband, Bill Neal. "Stephen, if you don't have a good time at a party, it's your own damn fault. You need to go over and introduce yourself to the person who doesn't have anyone to talk to. You need to extend yourself and go ask them questions." He would also send my dad gay porn, wrapped and taped up in shopping bags in case someone else accidentally opened it. "Oh my God, Stephen, their cocks are huge," my dad said. I didn't really know if my dad was gay or bi. He dated one woman seriously for many years, but I knew he wasn't in love with her. Then he dated a sexy young college professor who he was crazy about. He said she really knew how to make a man feel like a man. I would wonder about his sexuality sometimes, and then I would just push away the thought. When Fritz met my dad, he said, "You know, your dad has a real queenie side." I just said, "What? A queenie side? What do you mean?" But now pieces from the past began to fit together. There had certainly been signs, but I never fully acknowledged that he might be gay. I used to buy little headshots of Joan Crawford or Betty Davis, and I would sign them and add a little message, "Dear Daddy, NYU is great. Look at Joan." But it did not dawn on me that he was gay or bi. I just thought, my dad will love this. Like when I saved up all my money to get new, expensive, full-color headshots, and after I mailed him one, he got out the glue and threw sparkles all around my face and framed it. Or when my dad and Mary and I watched this movie on TV, Ode to Billy Joe, starring Robbie Benson and Glynis O'Connor. It was about a closeted country boy in Mississippi who has sex with a man and commits suicide by jumping off the Tallahatchie Bridge, and was based on the country song Ode to Billy Joe by Bobby Gentry. Mary and I didn't really understand the ending, but I remember my dad getting really emotional. Now it seems impossible that they even put a movie like that on television in the 1970s. And of course, much later, I would reference the kinds of TV movies that I grew up on in MKG's dramatic monologues. The way my dad would be so enamored with some of my male friends and say, "Wow, he is movie star handsome." He loved Jimmy Fallon, and he would say, "You should be with someone like Jimmy." I would say, "Oh, Jimmy's my friend." And I would think, "Seems more like he wants to be with Jimmy." But I never saw any of that as part of his sexuality. Just a few months before I learned that my dad was gay, or bi, I always say or bi since my dad didn't live to describe his sexuality and I want to be respectful, so maybe queer or no label. He'd been trying to give up smoking. His method was to smoke cigarettes slowly, glamorously, while looking in a handheld mirror very intently. He'd heard that if you watched yourself smoking and really meditated on what you were trying to stop doing, it would help you quit. But it was so dramatic and so glam. My brother-in-law saw him doing it and thought it was hilarious. "Your dad is so eccentric," he told Mary. The night after the fight and my finding out about my dad's sexuality, Lorne and Marcy threw me a big farewell party at the Hudson Hotel, and I saw my dad and the world through new eyes. This giant thing had been revealed to me, and I'd told Fritz, who was very excited and happy for me. But I didn't say anything to my dad. He was wearing this camel overcoat over a tailored black suit, and he looked so elegant. It was the opposite of the previous night. My dad was amazing. Stone sober, of course. I felt such deep love for my dad that night. He talked to everyone and made real connections. The party was so much fun. Brian Smy presented me with all my padding as a going-away gift. Toasts were made. It was a magical night. I honestly felt that I could retire right there. My dad talked to both Marcy and Lorne for a long time and really connected with them. I remember feeling incredible understanding for my dad now that I knew this truth about his sexuality. Right as I was having these thoughts, Marcy came up to me, tears in her eyes, and told me, "Jim Shannon, I love that man. You don't understand, Molly. I love your dad." She also told me she wanted to marry my dad. My dad wrote this letter of thanks to Lorne. "To my friend, Mr. Lorne Michaels. Thank you for giving Molly the break of her life on Saturday Night Live, and also the many kindnesses you have given her and numerous others in launching their careers. You are a very special person, and your kindness knows no bounds. Your special interest in her career is deeply appreciated by me. Also, thanks for the wonderful party you gave her at the Hudson Hotel penthouse, and also for inviting me to be a part of the Mother's Day special. Words cannot express the many thoughtful things you have done. Sincerely, Jim Shannon." Chapter 19. My Mom. Shortly after the trip to Boca Raton, I got a letter with a Cleveland postmark. My dad had asked my mom's good childhood friend, Jean McConville, to get in touch with me. "Dear Molly, your mom was my friend. She lived down the street from me on West 101st Street. We walked together every day to St. Ignatius Grammar School from the 4th through 8th grade. Mrs. Keating, your grandmother, made hot oatmeal every morning before leaving for work. Your mom and her brother Hubert would put the oatmeal into two bowls, throw out the cereal, and then put the two dirty cereal bowls in the sink so it looked like they ate the cereal. I really don't know if Huey ever ate the mush or not, but I know Peggy ate saltine crackers and a bottle of Pepsi for breakfast every morning. Mrs. Keating, your grandmother, was a very kind and generous lady who spoke English with a thick Irish brogue. They often had relatives from Ireland staying at their house for long periods. Mrs. Keating supported the family with a salary she earned working in a factory. Mr. Keating adored his beautiful Peggy, but he had a drinking problem and was unable to keep a job. Peggy lived in fear of someone coming over to her house and seeing her father on one of his bad days. This was very stressful for her. She loved her dad. My maternal grandparents came over from County Mayo on the wild west coast of Ireland. My grandfather, Owen Cadogan, who changed his name to Keating when he came to America, was from Achill Island, and my grandmother, Mary Madden, was from Caron. The two places are only a couple hundred feet apart, separated by the Achill Sound, but my grandparents never knew each other in Ireland. They met in the U.S., married, and had my Uncle Hugh and my mom. The Keatings lived on the west side of Cleveland, which was full of Irish immigrants. Everyone liked Mary Madden, my grandmother. She was a happy woman. On Thursdays, her friends would come over and they'd drink whiskey together. They'd be drinking and smoking. My grandfather fell into dark moods and went in and out of jobs. My grandmother liked to say, "He's a good man as long as he isn't drinking." But because he couldn't stop drinking, she was really the one who had to work, so she became a maid. My mom and my Uncle Hugh were latchkey kids. They had it tough, but they also had each other. Sometimes they'd come home from school and find their dad passed out on the front lawn. Uncle Hugh told me that when he skipped school once, this nun, Sister Gill, tracked down my mom and told her, "Peggy, go home and tell your mother what Hugh did." But instead, she stood on the corner waiting to warn him. Uncle Hugh said, "Don't tell Mom," and she didn't. They really looked out for each other. They were close. As adults, my mom and Uncle Hugh wrote long letters to each other. In one, he asked her, "What are you going to do after you graduate high school? Go to college, or are you going to work?" Because she loved books and wanted to teach reading and work as a librarian, she went to college and studied library science. But while she was in school, her mom died very suddenly. At the funeral, her mother's friends all told her, "Oh, she was so proud of you. She'd never known." After college, my mom got a job as a librarian at Woodland Hills Elementary School on the east side of Cleveland, way across town from where she'd grown up. My mom was passionate about getting kids to read. When my parents met, my dad didn't say much about my mom to his family. Usually, according to one of his sisters, my Aunt Mary Rita, when he dated a girl, he'd immediately start picking her apart. But all he said about my mom was, "She's really smart." And my aunt knew, this is it, this is the girl. Uncle Hugh thought my dad was a fancy Dan, a well-dressed guy from Shaker Heights. He told me my mom was so excited. She was a West Side girl, an Irish immigrant, and just head over heels. Peggy wasn't normally like that. June Reaney, my mom's best buddy from high school, told me, "I'll never forget when she met your dad. She described him as Clark Gable, Jack Kennedy, and Robert Redford all rolled into one. He was the handsomest guy, and she was in love." My mom wrote my dad a lot of letters. Tuesday. "Hello, you old bachelor. I hope you're not having too good a time. I feel very disappointed tonight because as yet I haven't heard from you. Earlier this evening, the phone rang while I was taking a bath. Thinking it might be you, I jumped out of the tub dripping wet to answer it. It was one of my father's friends. We had a very pleasant day at work today, laughed all day. It is already 10:30 and I haven't really accomplished too much at home tonight. Very discouraging. I don't really feel like writing too much more. Maybe tomorrow at work I'll dash off a line. My main purpose in writing was just to remind you that I love you and need you very much. Do you think of me very often? You are on my mind every minute of the day. I say to myself, I wonder what my Witsy's doing. Then I think, oh, he's probably so homesick for me. Then again I think, I don't know, maybe he's not even thinking about me. For a moment I'll get very generous and think, well, just as long as he's happy, that's all that counts. Then again, in my more selfish moments, I'll say to myself, I hope he's not having too good a time. What it all boils down to is that I really want the best of happiness and good luck for you. But in the process, I don't want you to love me less or take me for granted. I don't think I could ever take you for granted. Well, anyhow, good night. I've been talking in circles. Instead, I'll be square with you and tell you how much I deeply love you. Good night, nice boy. All my love, Peggy." After I was born, my mom called her father and he didn't pick up. My dad drove her over to his place on Olympia Road. She carried me inside to check on him while my dad waited in the car with my sister Mary. My dad waited such a long time that he started to wonder, what is taking Peg so long? He went in and found her in shock, holding me beside her father, who was passed out on the table, dead. My dad always said because my mom had been used to dealing with drinkers, she knew how to subtly get the point across that she was disappointed. She didn't raise her voice. She would just leave his dinner out and remove herself without a word. My mom's dad was an alcoholic, and then she married an alcoholic. The vicious generational cycles of alcoholism. When I was ready to really deal with my mom's death, when I was in my 30s, I sought out my Uncle Hugh. He was a tall, smart, stoic, handsome Irish guy who, like a lot of Irish immigrants, didn't have a formal education. But he built a very big, successful plumbing business and made good investments in real estate. I wanted to hear all about my mom from her brother's perspective, and he was so happy I was reaching out. "Your mom was the best," he said. "Believe me, I loved her. She was tough in defending me when we were kids, but later she had a problem with my drinking. She felt I shouldn't do it. And then your father defended me." I asked Uncle Hugh how he coped with my mom's death. "Boy in hell, I'm starting to cry right now. I was in such shock. I took over a year to get over it. I went back to the scene of the accident and really studied it to figure out what had happened. The pole he hit was bent in two different places. After your accident, they no longer permitted this type of light pole. They started to put them on a concrete foundation with an aluminum base. It was right before the ramp on Superior in St. Clair, 1968, over 40 years ago. And then I spent all this time at the funeral home. There were arguments about where your mom would be laid out after the accident. I wanted the funeral on the west side, but it ended up on the east side at the Schulte Funeral Home. After that, I really just disappeared. I took off after she died. I was never the same. I went on a drinking bender." On the phone, he told me, "My father was a drunk, I was a drunk, but it wasn't hard for me to quit drinking. I eventually really hustled and got sober in AA. My sponsor told me, don't worry about the steps and all that BS, just don't drink." And once Hugh'd stopped drinking, he was unstoppable. He was elected the first business manager of the Cleveland Plumbers Union Local 55 when they were building huge projects like the Perry Nuclear Power Plant on Lake Erie. "Were you angry at my dad after the accident?" I asked. "I never got angry. I got distant from him. And I stayed distant. I figured he fell asleep at the wheel. It's a long drive. You get tired. After that, your dad would call me sometimes when he was drinking, and he confided in me that he never got over the guilt of the accident. He couldn't get over it. He didn't want to live." Recently, as I was finishing this book, John Goulet, the counterman at Sands Deli, where we used to go after church, told me he remembered hearing about our car accident. His sister came up screaming to him how Peg Shannon, Katie, and Fran had been killed. She told him, "They were killed on Dead Man's Curve in an automobile accident." John explained, "On the Shoreway, when it turns into the Inner Belt, past East 9th Street, left two lanes, that's Dead Man's Curve. When trucks hit that in the past, they would overturn. Lots of accidents." Dead Man's Curve. I never knew it was called that. After I spoke with Uncle Hugh, my sister Mary sent me a list called Things I Remember About Mommy. I was so little when she died, I didn't remember any of what Mary remembered. It was so thoughtful of her to send me this. She liked Pepsi, buttermints, and onions. She liked the dancing bear from Captain Kangaroo. We would go get her when he came on. She liked to stop at the frosty counter at Higby's downtown. I think she knew the people who worked there. She used to sing and dance with us, dance with a dolly with a hole in her stocking. She read us lots of Dr. Seuss books, Little Bear and Little Black Sambo. When I was in first grade, she helped me with my homework every night and tried to make a game out of learning by letting me take a step around the dining table every time I got a flashcard right. She made the flashcards. In the middle of the night, she would allow us to come down and bring cereal boxes, Quisp and Captain Crunch, up to our beds. She would give us butter and saltine crackers and peanut butter crackers. You, Mommy, and Katie would pick up me and some friends from school. She would bring Ritz crackers and Kool-Aid and Dixie cups for all of us. We had a picnic before going to after-school activities. She taught me how to walk to St. Dominic's. She took piano lessons. She encouraged us to draw. I remember our mom chasing me and my two sisters up the steps, grabbing our toes, saying, "I'm going to get your little piggies." I don't have many memories of her, but this is a strong one, a joyful, playful one. At the funeral, one side of the church was so full of mourners, it seemed like the whole west side had come. And that entire side of the church was just crying. Uncle Hugh told me, "Your mom had so many friends. People loved her. She was so kind. It was a mistake that she and your father moved to Shaker Heights. Her friends were all from the west side. The east siders were more aggressive, and your mom wasn't used to that. She was used to west side girls, west side people." My grandmother's brother was a priest, Father Willie Madden, who also came over to Cleveland from Quran. Mary told me, "Father Willie said he has never been to a sadder funeral than Mommy's, Katie's, and Fran." He said, "All the caskets in the aisle." I forget who else told me. The wailing from the west side of Cleveland was immense. After my mom died, the kids she taught wrote down their memories of her. I have all these sweet notes from her students. Whenever we think about books full of good stories, we will remember our friend. I am writing a poem about Mrs. Shannon. She told us so many good stories. She liked to smile and laugh. I remember the fun work Mrs. Shannon gave us. She was the best library teacher we ever had. Big book, small book, Mrs. Shannon was the chief of all books. I remember Mrs. Shannon when she helped me find a book about electronic brains and iron and steel. I remember she was always smiling. I remember the time Mrs. Shannon took us outside and we sat in the grass and read the Book of Riddles. She was lovable, truthful, honorable, and best of all, she was my friend. While working on this memoir, I found some pages my dad had written about my mom after the accident. He wrote, "After we got in bed at the end of a full day, Peg would light up a cigarette, often her first of the day, and she loved to talk about what Mary or Molly or Katie did or said and what they had learned, their new expressions of anger, happiness, fear, or how cute this was, or funny that mad expression on Katie's face was when she didn't want to do what she was told. I could tell from Peg's voice how much she thoroughly enjoyed talking about her children. It is indeed a great consolation to me now, remembering the many times we impulsively decided to take the girls to go out to a nice restaurant and have an enjoyable time as a family, or stop at a summer carnival on a way to visit someone, or have a picnic on the spur of the moment at a pleasant little park not far from our home just to see the kids have fun, or a Sunday at the zoo, or hamburgers on the way home, Christmas, Santa Claus, the bunny, Halloween, the wicked witches and pumpkins, those colorful drives in autumn, Thanksgiving and the feast of turkey with friends. These are the memories I will long cherish of our life together." Or the time she was completely surprised with the diamond ring I gave her for Christmas, which matched her engagement ring at a time when we certainly couldn't afford it, but somehow always managed to pay for, and the many other things we did and couldn't afford. These are the days I'll always remember, and I pray Mary and Molly will remember their mother and all the happy times when they look at all those snapshots. What never ceased to amaze me was her talent to make friends with such a variety of people, the compassion and understanding she had for the poor, underprivileged, the uneducated, and the overindulgent rich, but mostly for her fellow man in general. My wife's persistence in learning to play the piano at an age when most women are thinking of less taxing recreations, and the pride she enjoyed in her accomplishment, seeing the pleasure it gave us, listening to her play her latest song or my favorite Laura's theme, with the children playing before a crackling fire while I lay on the couch. To have the room completed before the children made a mess of everything. Before we could clean it up, the happiness in seeing our labors make for a more beautiful home with the main ingredient, love apparent in our communication with one another. Weekend vacations with other couples to nearby towns, or the real big city ski resort where her persistence to manage the slopes was impressive. Her inquisitiveness and sailing on our first date and her enthusiasm wanting to buy a boat, enumerating what family fun it would be, or the time we decided to buy a camper and just take off for a month and visit places we had never been before and new spots for summer. Thank God I have these memories, Her love of life, or the time we took horseback riding lessons, her fear a little obvious, and her desire to be an observer on our first visit to the riding academy, but she wasn't an observer long. It was after several lessons that she finally decided that she didn't think it necessary to follow all the protocol of English riding, as she had no intention of ever entering any shows. The fact that it was so expensive and she could never keep up with the horsey set. But nothing ventured, nothing gained was her motto, as we continued to pursue new activities, even if some of them didn't last very long. I'll never forget the stimulating effect Peg had on me when the new brochures arrived in fall and winter, offering a variety of courses for adults in Shaker school system, and her enrolling in tennis one semester, Spanish another time, speed reading another time, and the exhausting research she just finished in basic reference for additional credit to aid her in library science. The regrettable fact is that after all her exhausting work, she never lived to learn that she received an A in the course, but I'm sure she has better than an A+ now. In one of her many letters to my dad, my mother wrote, "My morning at work was very lonely without your phone call. I had nothing to look forward to. I love you very much, and if I permitted myself, I would miss you frantically. However, I am not permitting myself, so I just miss you very, very, very much. Yes, such a nice boy. Be very careful driving home. Don't drive if you're tired, and don't drink when you're driving." Chapter 20, Coming Out. We wrote and rehearsed the Mother's Day special during the first week of May 2001. Then it was pre-taped and broadcast on Sunday the 13th. All the mothers and the two dads did a song in the opening monologue, and each parent got to do a sketch with their son or daughter. "Daddy," I said as we rehearsed, "you're singing off key." I remember Chris Kattan turned around and started laughing when I said that. "You're throwing everyone off. Just try to mouth the words, okay?" And then the choreography was confusing too. Paula Pell told me, "Oh, don't worry. It's fine if your dad wants to make up his own steps. He's doing his own thing, his own dance." He had been so encouraging to me, so this was a small gift I could give him back. And it was so much fun having my dad with me as we went to hair and makeup and rehearsed in front of an audience together. When he bumped into Renee Zellweger after the live show, she was the host, she gave him so many kisses on the cheek. He said she reminded him of Judy Garland, and this was way before she actually played Judy Garland. During the Mother's Day rehearsals, I came into the dressing room and found my dad shivering and closing his eyes for quick little naps, tired. He was with all the moms waiting to rehearse. Will Ferrell's mom, Kay, put her hand on my dad's shoulder and said, "Jim, Jim, I'm worried about you, Jim. Put a sweater on." He seemed weak, frail, off. And I got a little frustrated that he couldn't pull it together for our father-daughter pre-taped bit. He just said, "Oh, this is exhausting. Wow, Molly, there's a hell of a lot people don't realize about how much goes into it." After rehearsal one evening, we walked back to the Palace Hotel on Madison and 50th. Ayala, my friend who worked in the talent department at SNL, had arranged for him to stay there because he'd told her, "I want to be close to St. Patrick's Cathedral." Though when Ayala asked if he wanted a massage or pedicure, he told her no. "More for ladies," he said. Now we were just sitting in his room talking. He looked like he was going to confide in me, and I thought, "He's going to tell me. He's going to tell me." Ever since my conversation with Stephen Levy in February, Stephen had been saying about my dad, "He's going to tell you. He's going to tell you." So that's what I was expecting. Instead, he said, "Molly, I have prostate cancer." And I started crying so hard. All his behavior over the last few months made sense now. The shivering, the tiredness, the weight loss, the drinking when he came for my last SNL. He had cancer. He was scared. He had also been jealous that I'd also invited Fritz's dad to my last show. Keeping so much bottled up inside, it was no wonder he wanted to drink. For months, he had chosen to keep his cancer private, but now he was telling me. He also told me he had pre-taped a recorded conversation with Dr. Marty Resnick, the director of urology at University Hospitals of Cleveland, discussing the hormone therapy drug Lupron, which Dr. Resnick recommended for my dad. My dad asked if he could play the tape back for me. Sitting there together, I heard my dad tell Dr. Resnick, "I do have a death wish." At the time, George Cheeks was dating a doctor, Larry Hausman, who treated cancer patients at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. When I told George about my dad's cancer, he put his boyfriend in touch with me. Larry gave me some facts about my dad's hormone treatment, which would reduce his testosterone, saying, "Lupron will keep him alive longer, and the side effects aren't bad, but the best thing you can do is be around him." My dad joked that since he was getting female hormone shots, he was going to buy a dress. After the Mother's Day special aired, a beautiful piece about my dad came out in the Cleveland Plain Dealer. The article was written by their TV critic Tom Farron and illustrated with a big picture of my dad and me during the special. I called my dad to celebrate, but he seemed disappointed. "Oh, Molly," he said, "I look so thin on TV. I hated the way I looked. I looked just terrible." It stabbed me in the heart. I had made his dream come true, and he couldn't fully enjoy it. I finally got him on TV, but he was sick. I tried to cheer him up. "Daddy, all actors think they look terrible on TV. I can't stand seeing myself on screen. Most people think that. Welcome to showbiz. We are all hard on ourselves, trust me." "Is that right? Oh, Molly, that makes me feel so much better," he said. I said, "A lot of people don't even watch themselves, ever. I thought you looked good." Then he read the article out loud to me on the phone, and he started crying. He loved it. Lauren always said he could be in the New York Times and his mom wouldn't be impressed, but when there was an article about him in her local paper, it was such a big, big deal, and it meant so much to my dad to be in his hometown paper. Shortly after that, in June of 2001, Fritz and I went on an all-expenses-paid safari in Zimbabwe for a travel show. My dad seemed to be doing well with his cancer treatments, and Fritz and I wanted a chance to spend some time traveling together. We were out looking at lions every day from those open-air vehicles. Our guide kept pointing out the old lions. When the older male lions know they are dying, they go off by themselves. I remember feeling so sad about those old lions. I felt sad that they needed to be private when they were failing, that they started separating from their loved ones, that they were so tired. The end of life. I was thinking a lot about lions dying. These lions. And my dad was really on my mind. My dad kept calling me on the trip. We had these long conversations in Africa when I could tell he really needed me. He was pulling toward me and asking me about everything in my life. He was the opposite of the lions. He was trying to come close, not pull away. And I felt close to him. I think it was hard for him because I was so far away. But in my gut, I was worried. Even though coming closer was the opposite of how the lions died, I still kept thinking of my dad and these elderly male lions in the same way. Maybe he's like the lions. Maybe he's dying too. After returning from safari, I went on a press junket for the film Serendipity. I played the best friend of the main character, Kate Beckinsale. At one point in the movie, there's a mix-up where somebody's parents think her character and my character are a couple. My favorite moment filming was when I asked the director, Peter Chelsom, "Can I say when I see off Kate, goodbye, my sweet lesbian lady lover?" He hesitated. Once again, it didn't look like a joke on paper, but I don't think he could tell how I was going to say it when I was performing it. Hitting all the L's really hard. "Goodbye, my sweet lesbian lady lover." I love the way it sounded. It was that comedy as music idea. And when he finally did let me try it, it got a huge laugh. Knowing that my dad was sick, I invited him to fly out to LA on August 22nd and join me for the Serendipity junket. The studio was putting us up at the Four Seasons, and I thought it would be so much fun for my dad and me. We went to the premiere together, and afterward, I just felt this urgency for him to see all my friends. So I planned all these dinners for him. I thought it would be fun. One night we had a dinner with Will Ferrell, his wife Vivica Pollan-Farrell. Another night, Heather Graham at Asia de Cuba. And then another dinner with my friend Mike Rad at La Conda Veneta. And a dinner with Eugene Pack, his wife Dale Rafel, and Allison Earle, who'd moved to Santa Barbara, and her husband Jim at Panavino. And then another dinner with Stephen Levy and his mom at Spago. My friend John Hoffman and his boyfriend Tony Leondis at Orso. Every single night out with friends. My dad thought it was so sweet, but he felt bad he didn't have his usual energy. He said, "I really just want to hang out with you." We also went to see my amazing therapist. He got all dressed up for the session in a white turtleneck and a white sweater with a shamrock stitched on it. When she told him he'd had to play both parental roles, mother and father, he liked that a lot. "I never thought of it that way," he said. My dad was so friendly to everyone at the Four Seasons. They all knew him and liked him, and for years afterward, whenever I went back to the hotel, they all asked about my dad. We called Dr. Resnick in Cleveland to get the results of my dad's recent PSA test and were so relieved because the numbers looked okay. Then we paged Dr. Larry Hausman, George Cheeks' boyfriend, and when he heard the numbers, he said, "He's doing well." It was good news. My dad was so happy. "Oh, good, good. You don't know how relieved and happy that makes me feel," he said. We had adjoining rooms at the Four Seasons, and it was so fancy and fun. Since he still had not told me about being gay or bi, I thought, I'm just going to ask him. We went out to the pool. It was a gorgeous sunny day, and we were sitting on the lounge chairs next to the water, eating our Cobb salads in our cozy white robes. I took a deep breath and seized the chance to ask the million-dollar question that a child can only ask a parent when they are still alive. "Have you ever thought you might be gay?" 8 words. When I said it, I saw a plane pulling a banner with my words on it across my eyes with a huge question mark at the end. Here we go. This is the question that has always needed to be asked but has never been asked. Here we are. The million-dollar moment. He instantly responded, "Most definitely." "Really? Wow. Wait. Oh, my God. What did he just say? Heart beating fast. I can't believe what I'm hearing. Wait. Holy shit. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God." We moved over to another part of the pool. Since he seemed so open and willing to talk, I asked more questions. The conversation continued for the next 72 hours. After the press junket was over, we drove up to Ojai, about 90 minutes north of L.A., and continued talking about everything. We stopped at the Caro's Diner when we got there and sat for hours and hours as he told me about this hidden part of his life. He had a fruit cup and I had an Irish cream coffee. It was fantastic. I got to ask him anything and everything. Oh, Molly, I knew when I was in 8th grade. I would go on double dates with girls, but I always liked the boy. I had a crush on this Polish boy. I liked the way his fingers held his cigarette. His hand looked so glamorous. I would try to hold my cigarette like him. I liked how he looked so macho. I also used to look at men in their undershirts in magazines. I liked their big builds. I wished I could be built like that. "I tried to tell your mom. Right around the time you were born, I even went to a psychiatrist who told me I was a latent homosexual. I told your mom when I got home from the appointment straight out. She got mad. She didn't want to hear it. She told me the therapist should never have said that to me." When he went to conventions and on business trips, sometimes men would give him the eye and slip their business cards into his pocket. He said it made him feel all mixed up. "I don't want to take your card, but I do. But I don't. But I do. How dare you?" He felt mad at the men. Mad, but intrigued. He told me his gay life was mostly limited to occasional blowjobs at bars and truck stops, a common practice in that day and age, and something that he and many others did due to the closeted mindset about homosexuality in that era. I was happy to hear he had gotten some action. I realize this sounds inappropriate, but I was very happy to hear this. We were close, so I thought, oh, good. Mr. O'Neill had also known about my dad's sexuality. I think Mr. O'Neill may really have been the only person I knew whom he'd told before Stephen Levy. It had been an element of their close friendship. "Did you and Mr. O'Neill..." Bill loved me, but I didn't feel that way about him. We talked about everything. I remembered one time in the 90s we'd seen a gay kiss on TV and my dad had said, "I don't think that's right, two men kissing." And I'd replied, "I think that's right. I think that's just right." Now I think my dad was born a generation or two too early. If he had been born in a different era, he probably would have had a boyfriend. He couldn't break out of what was expected of him as a Catholic growing up in Cleveland in the 1930s and 40s, and he never left Ohio. I don't think my dad was attracted to Mr. O'Neill. He had so many complicated feelings about being a homosexual. He had a self-hatred for being attracted to men. It was against God's will. He wrote on a yellow pad of paper, "Why, God?" But they had a deep, beautiful friendship. And on one of my first trips back to Cleveland from NYU, I remember describing all my fellow theater students to him and Mr. O'Neill by saying, "Everyone's gay!" It felt real and exciting. Everyone is gay, and everyone's coming out and tap dancing. I just felt like, this is fantastic. New York City was so different from Cleveland. When Debbie Palermo's roommate's mom told Mrs. Palermo that Debbie was gay and that she didn't want her daughter to be living with a sinner, Mrs. Palermo threw the phone across the room because she was upset Debbie didn't tell her first. Her roommate's mom had told her before Debbie could tell her, and she was shocked because she wanted to defend Deb. Debbie told me, "Oh, my mom's so upset I didn't tell her first, and that she had to hear it from some judgmental mom." I was glad that there were so many boys at NYU who were suddenly coming out of the closet and announcing they were gay. I loved being in an atmosphere that was liberal and artsy and where everybody could find themselves. I wanted to subconsciously push them with this information, to test them and see how they would react. My dad and Mr. O'Neill said, "Really?" They loved hearing about it. Mr. O'Neill had died 8 years before I finally had this full, open conversation with my dad in Ojai. My dad had been on a trip to Prague, but as he said, the Holy Spirit was guiding me and told me to cut the trip short. Mr. O'Neill had gotten so thin by that time. When my dad came back, he went straight to Mr. O'Neill's house and told him, "The rescue squad is coming over." Mr. O'Neill complained that he wasn't ready, but my dad said, "They're coming anyway." Once Mr. O'Neill was in the hospital, my dad visited all the time. He discovered that Mr. O'Neill's house and finances were in terrible shape. Mr. O'Neill confessed that he had not collected the rent from his tenant for 4 years. He said, "Oh, what is wrong with me, Jim?" My dad said, "Oh, Bill." On one of these visits, he and Mary brought Mr. O'Neill a TV set. But as they were carrying it through the hospital, a nurse told them, "I'm sorry, he's expired." And my dad said, "Expired?" They hadn't even called to tell him. Gay people have fought for these things for so long. My dad said, "Bill always knew that he would die before me because he would say things like, 'Jim, when I go, lay me out well. Give me a good one.'" Mary and I both flew home to Cleveland. The day of the funeral, we had to stop at the mortuary to pay our last visit before they closed the casket. My dad looked devastated. First, he kneeled and said some prayers. Then he stood up and looked in. Watching him, his shoulders seemed so little. His feet did, too. He put his hand on Mr. O'Neill's hand. Then we left the room and drove to the cemetery in a rented limo. My dad was a little grumpy in the car. There were 12 people who actually came to the cemetery. It was cold and gray. The priest said a few words. My dad stood alone, closest to the casket. I saw my dad's friend Ann Doyle sobbing. She had dated Mr. O'Neill a long time ago. I cried a lot because my dad had lost his best friend of 50 years and because I was worried about what he would be like when the pain really set in. Then we got back into the limo and talked about where you go after death. My dad said what he'd always said since Mary and I were little. When you're Catholic, when you die, you don't die. You have eternal life. As a girl, I remember asking him, "What's eternal life?" And he told me, "You live forever and ever and ever in heaven." Now Mary said, "The thought of forever and ever and ever makes me dizzy." I would spin around in circles in our living room when I was little, teasing my hair, thinking, "Forever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever," until I thought, "Ugh, this feels like too much to wrap my head around." I didn't like thinking about eternity. Now my dad told us, I'm not sure where you go, but I know that God takes care of you. Back on Winchell Road, he invited people over for drinks and sandwiches, the Irish tradition. Mary and I saw him pour himself a drink and cringed. He had been sober for a long time. Once he started drinking, he said, I should have been tougher on Bill, as if it were his fault that he was dead. Then he told us he had this dream about our mom. I said to her, look what beautiful daughters you have. You've missed them growing up. But she would never talk back. He asked me, Molly, are you aware that I substituted you for Peg after she died? You are just like your mother, and I was wrong to do that, but you knew what was going on, and you were such a good sport about it. And I'd take you to wakes and dinner parties, and even though you wanted to be with your friends, you went along with it. I said, yes. And he seemed surprised. It wasn't the first time we'd had this conversation. Once we'd watched an Oprah special on that subject, parents who make their children into surrogate spouses, and he'd said, I feel like I did that to you. I loved your mother so much, and you are just like her. I'd never seen my dad cry as much as he cried that day. He kept saying how lucky I was that I had such good, supportive friends in L.A., where I was still waitressing and working on my stage show. He said that my roommate Brian Donovan was the best, the finest, and he cried as he said it. The finest should be triple underscored, triple underscored. Then he added, it's too bad the funeral couldn't have been in California because you could have packed the house, Molly. Bill would have liked that. Ann Ranft came over and said she thought it was sad that my dad was drunk because he had just lost his best friend. The next morning, my dad woke up with a terrible hangover and told us, I never want to drink again. Before Mary and I flew back to New York and L.A., we went out to dinner and he asked us, who of all the people at the wake do you think made me feel the best? Before we could answer, he told us, John Goulet. The counterman at Sands Deli, who'd always been so nice to us. My dad said that a few months earlier, John Goulet had seen Mr. O'Neill, drunk as a skunk, at a Van Aken bar, despondent over a falling out with my dad and bawling like a baby, as he told John how much he loved my dad, how he was so lucky to have him, and that if anything happened, he wouldn't know what to do without him. As my dad told us all this, his face tightened up so he could hold back his tears, but they came out anyhow. I also wanted to cry, but I held myself tightly. I wanted to be strong. I couldn't let myself go until I'd left Cleveland and was up in the air listening to Ricky Lee Jones on a plane back to L.A., hiding my face so the seat next to me wouldn't know I was crying, thinking, just 25 years ago, my mom, my sister, and my cousin died. Death brings up so much. All the love and the truth can pour out at the end. When I got back to L.A., I talked to my dad on the phone. He said he just watched Jeopardy and he couldn't believe that he couldn't pick up the phone to call Bill like he always did. He said he was still in shock about the whole thing. He said he was disappointed that none of his siblings had come to the funeral and that only 12 people showed up at our house. I wish there could have been more for Bill, he said. He said he would pray for them, but that it was going to be hard to get over. I told him that he should move to L.A. He said, yeah, maybe I'll get a little apartment or something. Now more than a decade had passed since he'd lost Mr. O'Neill. After my dad and I had our big talk at Caro's Diner, Allison, who'd always been so close to my dad, came down from Santa Barbara and met us for dinner at Suzanne's, this Italian restaurant in Ojai. It was her birthday, and my dad told Allison, it's all on Paramount Pictures. Allison had always totally gotten the silly side of my dad, and my dad kept saying it was on Paramount since Paramount Pictures was paying for everything. We had the time of our lives, laughing until late. The whole evening was like a dream. Later, though, my dad told me that his favorite part of the whole trip was sitting at Caro's Diner, just me and him, talking. I was happy for him that he had finally felt able to come out to me. He never got to come out to his friends or his immediate family. I'm so glad that I asked the question. I'm so glad that he answered. And I'm so glad that he wanted to answer. I feel that everything happened the way it was supposed to happen. I'm even happy he showed up drinking that final SNL night because it set into motion pivotal conversations and allowed us to have those final wonderful months where so much was revealed and shared. My dad's neighbor on Winchell Road told me that a few months after our big talk in Ojai, your dad put up Christmas lights in the window for the first time ever. Boy, did they look beautiful. Chapter 21, Small Parts. We were on the phone for 86 minutes the last time we talked. It was such a good conversation. I was so lucky that I had left SNL because we got to talk so much more than we would have been able to if I had still been busy with the show. He was glad I had left. He didn't want me to be working so hard. I didn't bring up what we had talked about in California. It was a big thing to tell. I figured if he wanted to talk about any of that again, I would let him lead. He must have thought all about our conversation at the Four Seasons. I could tell because what he said to me was this. The best thing I ever did was have you girls, you and Mary. That's the best thing I ever did. And then he said, I just want you to know you're my lucky star. Thank you, I said. Thank you. He really wanted me to know that. And in a letter he told me, you and Mary are my best buddies and always will be. My love for you and Mary will always continue. And any problems either of you have, I want to be there to show you my deep love and console you both and comfort you and understand you in any and every way I can. Then we had a quick conversation 4 days later on a Saturday afternoon, before he went to a family wedding. He was a little worried about money. He said assisted living can be $6,000 a month. Times 12, that's $72,000. I told him he should come to New York City and live in the studio I owned. He didn't want to do that. I invited him to California. He said he would think about it and get back to me. And he started weeping. A few hours later at the wedding, he suddenly put too much pressure on one of his legs and cracked his femur. He was at his best, stone sober, making the rounds, talking to everyone, being his charming, sweet self, and then crack! The prostate cancer had advanced enough to spread into the bone. If he had not taken the Lupron, it would have spread to the bones faster, George's boyfriend Larry told me later. Lupron kept him alive. But when you break a bone, and you have cancer, and your immune system is compromised because you are suddenly immobilized, you get pneumonia in the hospital, and then you get a staph infection, and it kills you. When he arrived at the hospital, he was afraid his family was going to spread rumors about what had happened at the wedding. He did not want people thinking he had fallen or that he had been drinking. No misinformation. He just stood up the wrong way and the femur cracked. My dad would have liked to have gotten away from some members of that big family and into piano bars. I was waiting for my dad to call back to let me know if he decided to come to California. It seemed like days had passed and I had not heard back. Then I got a call from Aunt Bernie saying, your dad is not good. He's in the hospital. He doesn't want you to know. He doesn't want you to worry. But his oncologist told Aunt Bernie she should call us girls. I packed my bags so fast and caught a cab at JFK, listening to Back in Black on my headphones to soundtrack the urgency I felt heading to the airport. He went into the hospital, and he never came back out. He was there for 5 days total. By the time I got there, he couldn't talk much. He was coughing a lot. My dad did not fear dying. He was a rebel and a radical. He felt like he'd lived a good life. He was ready to die. So when cancer took him, he didn't mind. I don't want to live and be really old and dependent, he said. He'd smoke cigarettes because he didn't want to live to be too old. That tape-recorded conversation with his doctor wasn't the only time he said he had a death wish. I'm so ready. I've lived such a good, full life, he said. He was 72. He had done as much as he wanted to do. He'd said everything he needed to say. He caught pneumonia in the hospital and was coughing all the time. I wanted to bring him salt water so that he could gargle and get some relief. I left his room to get a big cup of it. Salt, we need salt, salt, salt. That's going to get all that shit out of there. The salt water helped him more than anything. The next day I brought him more packs of salt, but by then it was clear that the salt was no longer going to help. though he was still trying really hard to speak, even to make jokes. At one point, when they were moving him every which way to take x-rays, he finally told the technicians, "If you guys don't stop, I'm going to call 911. Get me out of this hospital!" He said he didn't want any visitors, just Mary and me. Though eventually he made an exception for Ann Ranft and Mrs. Ranft, and he asked about Stephen Levy a lot. Then he fell asleep. As I was sitting quietly in the room while he slept, a nurse who worked in radiology came and sat next to me. She said, "I know your dad. He comes in to get his Lupron shots, and he's always dressed up in a suit with a tie. He talks about you and Mary all the time, telling me all about you too." "He does? He dresses up and wears a tie when he comes in for his Lupron?" She told me she did in-home care work, and I asked for her number. I was still thinking he was going to come home. My sister knew he wasn't coming home, but I was still in denial, wanting to do anything and everything I could to get him better. I couldn't accept it. The nurse had to take me out of the room and say, "He's dying. This is it." Had I not quit the show, I would not have had that time for that last long phone call with him. I wouldn't have had those 86 minutes to talk. When people ask me if I regret leaving SNL, I say no, because if I had not left, I never could have had that conversation on the phone. I would have been too busy, like a doctor always on call. That was my last big conversation with him. I fucking got it in the end. It was like a miracle. It was beautiful. I'm a spiritual person, and it could not have gone better. Just because he admitted he was gay or bi didn't mean that he didn't love being a father to Mary and me. He wanted me to understand how much he loved that he got to be our dad. During that phone call, he was able to really talk. Once he was in the hospital, he could barely speak, so thank God we had that long talk. I don't take things like that for granted. Not everyone gets that in death. This is the gift I will carry in my heart. After he died, I looked at all my dad's old phone bill, seeing exactly how many minutes I talked to him in those last few months. 90 minutes there, 30 minutes there, 15 there. I wanted to make sure he felt loved. I would obsess about it. I graphed it like a math problem. I highlighted all my phone bills, looking at the minutes we talked, made charts, wrote it all out in a notebook, wanting proof. It was part of my grieving. The more I graphed, the more comfort I felt. I held his hands in the hospital room. He was dying. "These sweet hands have done so much for me for the last 37 years, I thought. My dad would wave for me from the big front window every single time I left the house as I walked up the street. Every single time. We would keep waving back and forth as I walked up Winchell Road until I was out of sight. I felt incredibly honored to be there while he was dying. I had lost my mom so abruptly. I treasured the good ending with my dad, that the rug was not pulled out from under me so suddenly that I had time to say goodbye. After being rushed to the hospital, my dad almost immediately developed a staph infection. It spread quickly to his lungs and kept him from being able to talk for more than a few sentences at a stretch. So that phone conversation really was the last time we talked. He gave Mary and me a bunch of advice on the day that he died. He was speaking so softly we could hardly hear him. "I want to be hooked up to the morphine," he said. "But first, let me give you girls advice. So Molly, get married to Fritz because it's a good thing to get married. Don't delay. You need to have children because that's the greatest thing you could ever do in life." He knew I wanted to be a mom. "Get married and go on," he said. "Don't cry for me, because I'll be happy." "Will you watch over us from heaven?" we asked. "Indeed," he said. Now Mrs. Ranft was taking photos of him while he was dying. They brought in the morphine, and we knew once he'd had that, he was going to be slipping away. He knew what was happening and began saying his very last words. He could barely talk. Before he could begin speaking, he had to take a big hit of oxygen. So he'd do this deep breath and then speak. First he said, "Get along, you and Mary, get along." My dad had been a fan of this one movie I'd been in called Analyze This. Billy Crystal played a therapist and I was one of his patients, Caroline, who had just been through a breakup and was crying all through her session. At the end of the hour, the therapist tried to kick me out, and I told him that he was just like my ex. Then he said, "Carolyn, you know that's not true. I'm going to see you next week, whereas Steve never wants to see you again." My dad just loved this little scene. So we took a big inhale of oxygen to give some more advice, and we leaned in. We could hardly hear him. And then he said, "Small parts." "Okay, small parts, yeah?" We repeated, trying to make out what he was saying. Then he took another deep inhale of oxygen and said, "In movies." So now we repeated, "In movies, yeah, in movies." Then he took a final deep inhale. "Like, analyze this." And then he died. I'm not kidding. His final advice was, don't ever underestimate a good small part in a movie like Analyze This. There are no small parts. That was literally the last thing, and he was flatline dead. As we sat there in silence over my father's body, for some reason Ann Ramp's mom asked a completely random question. "Molly, who was that guy you dated and broke up with?" And with that, my dad rose up from the bed. We thought he was dead, but now he came back to life and made a sound like, "Rah!" One hand up in the air, fingers spread out like a claw. And then he went back to the dead. Because a boy had hurt his little girl, and my dad knew, my dad cursed an ex-boyfriend on his deathbed. He was dead, and he actually came back to life for me. I got in touch with my dad's oncologist to thank him for having Aunt Bernie call Mary and me to the hospital when he did. If he hadn't told my aunt to call us, I don't know if we would have made it to the hospital. He said my dad knew it was time. He said it was a blessing he died when he did. He would have been in a lot of pain. No radiation, that was his choice. He was totally clear of mine, not delirious or incompetent. After my dad died, so many people called and sent letters and flowers. Eugene Pack, Allison Earle, Steve Corin, Devin Mike Palermo, Jimmy Whalen from Cravings, George Cheeks, Drew Barrymore, Sherry O'Terry, Adam Sandler and Jackie Sandler, Robert Smigel, Matt Piedmont, Lynn Henderson, Lisa Sunstedt, Jimmy Fallon, Marcy Klein, Will Ferrell and Vivica Paulin Farrell, Rob Muir, and so many others. I wrote down what Lauren said. "Molly, I'm terribly sorry. It's an odd thing because this is the anniversary of my own father's death. It's terribly sad. But I know nobody made a parent prouder than your dad. He got to see you flourish and blossom." At his funeral, we played Judy Garland's Battle Hymn of the Republic as he had requested. My dad had written this on a yellow legal pad. "God is love. God is nature. God is the sun, the moon, and the stars, and all the planets in the outer universe. God is more than our feeble brain could ever conceive. God is the light." Chapter 22, Motherhood. Once when my kids Stella and Nolan were little, I took them Halloween shopping at Target. When we came outside, our car was gone. "Hey, our car is not here." "Oh no," I thought, "my car got towed." I didn't want to scare them. I thought, I'm the leader. I can't act panicked. So I decided I would make it like a mystery that we needed to solve. My kids were sort of in shock and replied, "Oh no, Mommy, what are we going to do?" I said, "It's okay. This is actually exciting. It's going to be an adventure. This is a good thing that has happened because it's going to lead us down an interesting path. So let's just be open and see where it takes us." It took them a while to get with the intrigue, and I had to hold back my own worry, but pretty soon we were all really into it, carrying around these mummies, skulls, and skeletons until we saw one of those Bureau of Street Services trucks parked down the street. Yes! I knocked on the window and I said, "If my car were theoretically towed, do you know where they would put it?" The driver said, "Oh, your car probably got towed since it's rush hour now. They would probably bring it over to Hollywood Tow." Then he did a double take and said, "Can I ask you, are you who I think you are?" I nodded my head, yes. "You were in Superstar, right? Get in here. I'll help you." So we all enthusiastically hopped into his truck. He let my kids play with the lights on the roof while he took us all to Hollywood Tow with our mummies and dummies tossed in the bed. Once we got there, he asked, "Are you okay? Do you have enough money? I can sit here in my truck and wait for you till you make sure your car is in there." Go get the car, write the check. They never saw mommy sweat. Obviously, this whole situation was helped by the fact that he recognized me. But I resolved that my kids would learn that this stuff happens in life, and what matters is your attitude and how you handle it. There's no need to get upset. Go get the car, write the check, get back on the road. Maybe it happened for some reason, and maybe the fact that this happened is some sort of protection. Who knows? They told everyone at school the next day, "Our car got towed. We got to ride in a truck, and we got to do the lights." It turned out to be the best day. Another time, I was driving Stella and Nolan and Nolan's friend Bobby to Bobby's favorite restaurant, CPK, when I ran out of gas. Nolan said, "Don't worry, Bobby. This happens all the time." Bobby said, "This has happened before?" Yes, it had happened before, but let's not tell anyone. Anyhow, it was very hectic. There were cars zooming by and we were all starving. Then Nolan said, "No, guys, it's a fun adventure. You'll see." At which point somebody pulled over, this nice guy who just helped us. I pointed out, "Most people are good. And then you get to meet this nice stranger and he's like an angel or something. And for some reason, maybe this is meant to be." I hope that my kids will see when they are adults not to stress out, that this stuff happens. It's part of life. It's how you handle it. In both cases, I thought, this is because of my dad. One morning, both my kids were tired and didn't seem ready to go to school. I said, "All right, let's be late. It's fine." So we all had what we call a slow start. We stopped at the griddle, had French toast, talked, and took turns taking items off the table and making the others guess what we'd removed. We had fun. After a while, I asked, "Now are you guys ready to go to school?" And they were. It's good to be responsible, but there's no point in being so stressed that you can't adjust or bend the rules a little when necessary, particularly when dealing with your kids. I'd rather send them to school happy and relaxed than send them to school when they aren't quite ready. That all comes from Jim Shannon. A few years ago, I was cast in the role of a mother who's dying of cancer. The movie was called Other People, and it was written by the brilliant Chris Kelly, a former head writer at SNL. It was his first screenplay and his directorial debut, and it's semi-autobiographical. His mother's life was cut short by cancer, and it was an honor to play her. I could tell she loved being a mother and that she was strong and funny. There's a beautiful scene where Jesse Plemons, the actor playing my son, says to his mother as she's dying, slipping away, "I want to take you on a trip. I want to take you all around the world." They're lying in bed and she's very sick. My character replies, "I get to see my whole world at dinner tonight. My kids, my family. That's my whole world." And that line takes my breath away because it is exactly how I feel too. I feel so lucky I got 4.5 years with my mom on Earth. I'm grateful I got that time with her. It's substantial, and thank God I had that. Losing my mom at such a young age gave me this urgency, like, this is it. You're up to bat, baby. Because you never know how much time you're going to have with someone. It gave me a sense of gratitude for the time on Earth you do have with people. I don't take any of it for granted. I love being a mom to Stella and Nolan. I truly feel like I hit the jackpot getting to be their mom. And some of the stuff that people complain about as far as parenting goes, I can't relate to. I just think, they're alive. We're all alive. Nobody is dead. I think that a lot. There is nothing to be upset about. We're alive. Getting to be here with my kids in a way that my mom wasn't, getting to do all the things for my kids that she never got to do because her life was cut short, is profoundly healing. So the script of Other People hit me deeply in many ways. My character tells her children, "All I ever wanted was to be a mother, and I got to do that 3 times. When I read that script, I read that line and I thought, yes, I relate to this so deeply with my heart and my soul. All I ever wanted was to be a mother ever since I was playing family on the playground in Ohio, telling all the other kids I'm the mother and I'm going to be the best mother. I always ask Stella and Nolan, do I seem like a stressed out mom or a happy mom? And they say, you seem happy. Acknowledgements. I would like to express gratitude to the following people. First and foremost, I would like to thank my collaborator, Sean Wilsey. It started with, let's generate some pages, and then you immediately had a vision for the whole book. I love how you and David Kurlander would make up songs about Jim Shannon. I learned from you that chronology can be overrated. You are so talented, Sean. A million thanks. Does that make sense? Thanks to my literary agent, Kim Witherspoon at Inkwell Management. Thank you for your guidance, toughness, patience, humor, and intelligence. And Maria Whalen, you are a delight. Thanks to my editors extraordinaire, Daniel Halpern and Gabriella Dube. I appreciate how passionate both of you have been since day one. Dan, thank you for talking things out on the phone and giving me the smartest advice. You are a legend and a joy. Gabriella, thanks for your unwavering support and enthusiasm. I am grateful for your steadiness and calm always. You keep everything moving forward and always with such grace and kindness. You are pure gold. Thanks to the entire HarperCollins Echo team, especially Helen Atzma, Miriam Parker, Megan Deans, Caitlin Mulrooney-Liskey, Lydia Weaver, Michelle Crow, Cindy HR, and Allison Saltzman. Andrew Jacobs for your excellent legal advice. Robert Abele for getting me started on this writing journey, listening to all my stories, and being so sweet and supportive. You made me feel so safe. It was easy opening up to you. I am enormously grateful to my friends who read drafts of my manuscript. Allison Earle, thank you for your insight and intelligence and silliness. You loved my dad. Thank you for all your excellent notes. You were way ahead of everyone in understanding literature when we were in grade school. I knew how smart you were then. Thank you for getting me so excited about the book and all your support. Anne Ranft, thanks for reading the manuscript and letting me share our childhood stories. Making up characters started with you. Steve Corin, you are always there for me. I am forever grateful. Thanks for your help on the book. You are so special to me, Steve. Chris Kelly, I treasure your encouragement. I deeply appreciate your perspective on the book. Your support means the world to me. And thanks, Chris and Sarah Schneider, for helping me settle on a title for the book after Allison Saltzman pitched Hello, Molly. And thanks, Allison, for designing the jacket cover. To my manager and friend, Stephen Levy, you are family. I've been working with you for so long, and I still get so excited when I see you calling. Thanks so much for reading my manuscript and sharing your stories. Debbie Palermo, you guided me through this book and made elements I was struggling with crystal clear. A million thanks, Deb, for your astute eye. Mike Palermo, you are so wise. You cut to the truth always. George Cheeks, thanks for believing in the book and always having my back and for reading the book multiple times. It means so much to me. I think I'll miss you most of all, Scarecrow. Mike White, thanks for helping me out at a critical time and for teaching me that vague, sentimental writing isn't good writing. I admire your bravery as a writer and take what you say very seriously. You always make me feel better and say just the right thing. Madeline Olneck, thanks for your superb notes. Thanks for telling me about the Dignity Catholics and for asking me to play the first ever on-screen queer Emily Dickinson in your movie Wild Nights with Emily. Brian Smy, my stuntman, thanks for being so protective of me all those years. I appreciate you letting me interview you for the book. You tell a story like no one else. Huge thanks to the resourceful, reliable Lori Berdan at SNL. Thanks for all your thorough research, Lori. To Lisa Sunstead and Pretty Funny Women, thanks for interviewing me for your class, Lisa, and for your support always. Arden Marin, you helped me so much in the beginning before I even had a proposal, showing me the ropes, answering all my questions, and guiding me. Joanna Parson, thanks for your transcription. Thank you, Edie Baskin, for the photographs. Mary Ellen Matthews, thanks for your phenomenal photographs and help. SNL is so fortunate to have you. Margot Hand, you believed I had a book in me way at the beginning. Cynthia Dupree Sweeney, thanks for your priceless guidance during this process. I take notes when you talk and save your excellent emails. Adam Resnick, you are just the best. You helped me so much on the book at a time when I really needed you. Thanks for always being there for me at the perfect time. I am forever grateful to you, Adam. John Goulet, thanks for letting me interview you. I cherish that call. It was easy to soak up what you were saying about your Corky and Lenny's days as a counterman because, as I told you, you have the voice of a professional broadcaster. Thanks for reminding me that it was my dad who brought you to your first meeting. You told me the first person God put in your path was my dad and how he said to you, "Don't worry, John, it's going to be okay. We can help you and get you back on the right track. All is not lost." And my dad would ask you, "John, what are you going to do tomorrow?" You were unsure, and my dad would say, "You're going to go to another meeting and I'm going to pick you up." Thanks for sharing these incredible stories. To my fabulous publicity team, Melissa Cates, Bria Schreiber, and Sergio Tapia, thank you for all your hard work on behalf of this book. You guys are the A-team. And to the wonderful Dennis Kao, Sean Bolter, and Suzanne Mitchell for making my audiobook. To my agents, Shaney Rosenzweig, Jonathan Weinstein, and Mike Jeline and the United Talent Agency, and Jason Richmond, thanks for introducing me to Kim Witherspoon in the first place. To my dynamic legal team, Steve Warren and Wee Win. Steve, your enthusiasm means the world to me. You are a force. Wee, thank you so much. You are just the best. Rob Muir, thanks for helping me with this book and taking the time to share your perspective. I'm so glad I met you so many years ago at that improv class. Also, thanks to our fellow writer performers in the Robin Molly Show so many years ago, Liza Coyle Murray and Alex Hirschlag. In writing about a part of my life, I may have left out people who were really important to me, so on that note, special thanks to all of you. Carolyn McKenzie, thanks for organizing everything and your keen writer's eye. You made all the material so accessible. Lauren Michaels, you changed my life. Thanks for giving me the break of a lifetime. I could talk to you endlessly. Marcy Klein, thanks for coming to my stage show all those years ago and for being so sweet to my family and for your help with this book and just everything. I also want to thank Eugene Pack, David Kurlander, Matt Piedmont, Andrew Schaefer, Heather Graham, Fred Wolf, Bill Neal, Aubrey Plaza, Portland Helmick, Barbara Earle, Lynn Henderson, Nicole Venables, Tim Long, Maureen Entrop, Shirley Shalit, Megan Mullally, Lauren Pomerantz, Elaine Soloway, Elizabeth Clark Zoya, Amy Brooks, Dale Rafel, John McGinnis, Addie Tavermina, Renee Stahl-Dechter, and Sandy Jones. You all helped me with this book in various ways. And just a general thanks to all my amazing friends who have supported me along the way. You know who you are. I want to list everyone, but then I'm worried I will forget and leave someone out. I like everyone to be happy, so this is the safest route. M, I am eternally grateful to you for everything. Thank you for encouraging me to go toward the love and to embrace my life. Thanks for teaching me how to turn my back on emotionally harmful people. You have helped me tremendously. Thanks for reading several drafts of my manuscript. Your blessing means everything to me. Thank you, Aunt Bernie. God bless you, Fran. Uncle Hugh, thanks for sharing all your memories about my mom when you were alive. And to my sister, Mary, thank you for allowing me to share some of your memories in my book. I really appreciate it. You are my big-hearted sister, and I love you. We survived these challenges together. Thanks, Shannon, Claire, and Jack, and Brian. A very special thank you to my wonderful husband, Fritz Chestnut. Thanks for reading the manuscript and for being so incredibly sweet and supportive the entire time and for really believing in me and the book. Thanks for reassuring me when I needed it most. You have been incredible. Fritz, you taught me how to smile. I'm just kidding. I just wanted to make you laugh. Seriously, though, I love it when you shake your hips and make up silly dances for me. There is nothing better. To my children, Stella and Nolan, you are my everything. I feel so lucky I get to be your mom. I love you, I love you, I love you. What an honor it is for me to get to see you growing up. I feel so fortunate I have gotten to live way beyond the years my mom lived. It is deeply healing and profound, and I do not take one second of it for granted. Stella and Nolan, you are my heart, my world. To my mom and Katie, I carry you in my heart forever. Mommy, I'm sorry you didn't get to watch us grow up. Thank you for passing on your love of books and reading. I hope I make you proud from heaven. To my dad, I always felt deeply loved by you. You gave me so much confidence. You were non-judgmental and way ahead of the times in inclusiveness. I loved your performing and your writing. Thanks for always believing in me. You helped me develop into the person I am today. Thanks for always being so interested in everything I had to say. I miss laughing with you. I miss your silliness. I get so excited when you pop up in my dreams. I listen to Tom Petty's Wildflowers when I drive around in my car and I think of you. This is Molly Shannon. This unabridged production of Hello Molly, a memoir by Molly Shannon with Sean Wilsey, presented by Echo and Harper Audio, was directed by Dennis Kao, and recorded at Outlaw Sound in Los Angeles, California. This program was produced by Literati Audio. Executive producer Suzanne Franco Mitchell. Text copyright 2022 by Molly Helen Shannon, Inc. Production copyright 2022 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.